Thank you, Mr. Vice President. By the way, it's safer these days being the vice president of a university. And as for a question, I understand, which has been posted on the campus and which I see also printed here, I guess the answer is nobody. Nobody. Except there is a safe distance here. It was with unusual interest that I returned to Florida again within a very few months. My last visit was in September, where I spoke at Florida Presbyterian College in St. Petersburg and at St. Leo's Abbey in Dade City. Then on arriving back at Santa Barbara, found myself served with a draft presentment for heresy by a committee headed by the two Episcopal bishops in Florida. One known as the Bishop of Florida and the other known as the Bishop of South Florida. Florida meaning the part of Florida which is not South Florida. Now, what will be the outcome of this visit? I don't know. I will be very eager to get at my special delivery registered return receipt mail on returning to Santa Barbara. But while I'm here, I'm enjoying it, just as I did innocently during my previous visit. We will know in a couple of years whether I'm a heretic. These procedures take a long time. I am without fear because I have before me the great example of how Joan of Arc turned out. They canonized her in the end, but of course she did have a heartwarming experience along the way. But times have changed. The secularists in our society have managed to prevent the churches from burning their own officials. Thank goodness for the unbelievers. What would we do without them to protect us from each other? Actually, the quotation from Emerson is, as your vice president knew, of course, much more relevant today than when he wrote it. Indeed, in the introduction, part of my address has already been given. I got a little nervous as he proceeded because he was ticking off point after point of what was going to be the first hour of my address. But he said it so promptly that we've saved a lot of time, and now I can be reassuring about the length of my remarks. You can count on being out of here not a minute later than 11:15. Some of you know these figures. In the last 25 years, there has been more change in culture, in our common life, than in the entire history of mankind up to the last 25 years. In the last year and a half, there's been more change than in the last 10 years. An MIT professor said last week that the number of new items, new things, whether minor technological ones or major breakthroughs, in a year is now 2 million items. He also said that if they kept their library complete, as they should, he felt, with all of the scientific and technological journals published in the world, they would have to be subscribing to 75,000 periodicals. It is a day of speed up and change at geometric progression. You look nicer in black. I see the men are still in tuxedos. I feel underdressed looking at them. No, some have changed. I feel overdressed. Well, the speed up, a geometric progression, is such that we can no longer talk of 100-year trends or even 10-year trends. And this is one reason for my constant traveling now and reading and studying and analyzing of reports, studying the church as institutions, seeking to help drag the church kicking and screaming into the 20th century, for which all of us have been rather badly prepared, including myself, because a theological seminary is a 17th century institution training men for a 19th century ministry. Because the trend is such that the church as institution is in grave peril, and we have very little time. We will reform, we will speak to our own time, or we will be through. I think you know that in practically every other country in the world, the church is down the graph in almost every regard. Perhaps you don't know the latest casualty. During my sabbatical, it was interesting to have been there the previous May for the clergy conferences of the Diocese of Suffolk, South Bank, London, 500 priests south of the Thames, and to hear the talk of the 6-year decline in every figure, not even taking population growth into account, to know that 19% drop in men for the ministry had occurred, and then to come back in the fall, last fall, and know immediately that something had happened. The death rattle you could hear. It shows how fast things happen now. Everything had descended sharply. The figure for reduction in men for the ministry was 38% in 1 year. The drop in baptisms, confirmations, church marriages, even church burials, right off the graph. Empty churches. And now, as summarized by the London Times, in a careful analysis of this, the Church of England is on the slippery slope, no way back up. To be there during a 6 months of a church with its beginnings in the 300s, in unbroken continuity, magnificent buildings, beautiful musical tradition, a great heritage, and dying before your very eyes with the smell of the carcass. It's a tragic, grave thing to be part of. I came back in the midst of it for our diocesan convention, and I told my clergy about it and said it could happen here. I was hardly back a few months, and I see our figures are starting down the graph. After the religious boom, after the last World War, a little while in it, I wrote an article for Life magazine called Christianity in Retreat. And people said, are you crazy? We're going up by the year, by the month. I said, I think a lot of it is pretty soft. Well, I was right. We tapered off, we leveled off. Now, just last week, the announcement down, for the first time, below the population curve in total membership. Attendance down, we've known for a few weeks. Sunday school attendance way down. Great drop in men for the ministry again, the same size. We don't have the complete figures on that. The Roman Catholic Diocese is a Middle West seminary. In the Middle West, and their seminaries have announced a 35% drop in seminarians in 1 year. You say, well, that's the problem of celibacy being discussed so openly. In part, it is. But apparently that isn't all that it is, because every one of our church's major denominations are finding the same thing happening this year. And a drop in the quality in terms of educational preparation. And therefore, greater generosity on the part of divinity schools in admitting candidates for graduate study of theology. The signs are upon us too. The bishop's in the minority during what is now known in my church as the Wheeling Dealing, filed a report in which they said of me, Bishop Pike thinks and speaks in a hurry, and thank goodness he does, we'd all better because there may not be much time. Forgive then the fact that I keep shifting as I write each book, because I am thinking fast and trying to get it out fast. We'd better if we have something to say. Because these days, as I say, things don't work themselves out slowly in 100-year drift. There's this high acceleration of change. We've seen it, as I say, in every other part of the world. We've also seen another phenomenon. In Scandinavian countries, with the decline and virtual death of the churches, in England we saw it very markedly, an increase, a marked increase of interest in religion at the same time as the decline of the institutional church. That's happening here too. And incidentally, those of you who are not Episcopalians should not overly rejoice in the demise of our mother church. Let me tell you something. The nonconformists, as they're called in England, are declining at an even faster rate. The smaller groups. It accounts for some of the interest in church unity that's so warm there now. You know, when your synod can meet in a telephone booth, it's time to make some friends. The Roman Catholic Church in England is suffering from it. They openly discuss it in such papers as The Universe and The Tablet, but they use a different word. It's an interesting one. The rest of us call it decline. They call it leakage. The increased interest in religion, heavy enrollments in divinity in Oxford and Cambridge and in all the new red brick universities too. On the BBC telly, as I learned to say over there, religion gets prime billing and time. I was privileged to do quite a bit of it when I was over. Enormous response to it, as the Mail showed. Religious books sell like hotcakes. The church attendance down to the point where in cathedral after cathedral that I visited in Thai, I kept my mornings free to observe clinically what was going on in the church. I preached in the evenings at college chapels at University at Cambridge and Oxford largely. The morning I went around in Thai, went to two or three churches at a time to see what's going on. Great cathedrals, vast ones. Generally, about the same number in the congregation as in the choreography, which would mean about 42. A very special day at Ely Cathedral, in which diocese Cambridge fell, the feast of the translation of St. Etheldreda, a very big day in their calendar, she being the 6th century foundress of everything, a mitred abbess, no less, ordained the diaconate as well, with all the things I wear, you know, things like this. Quite a woman. Two non-consummated marriages. Then she went into a nunnery, and she was already abbess in a year, and through her royal connections, made civil ruler of the Isle of Ely, which is still a separate jurisdiction in administration. We heard all about her in the gradual hymn between the Epistle and Gospel, a long Gregorian chant of 17 stanzas in English. Been better left in Latin, I think. But Dr. Norman, historian at Cambridge, whom I talked to one night when I went to Jesus, that's the college, and sitting at the high table, tells me there was an alternate theory about her, really. But he thinks that that gradual hymn perhaps is not correct. The other theory is that she did consummate those marriages, but when the bishop laid hands on her to ordain her, her virginity was miraculously restored. I don't know which of the two appeals to me the least. Well, that was a big day in the church calendar, so in Ely Cathedral, they had 61 that day at the main service of the week, which was quite heartening. Now they're beginning to talk about reformation and renewing the church. But it's awfully hard to renew the church after a certain point down the graph. I went to many a parish church where the attendance in a large, quaint building, often of great beauty, was the paid choir of four, since Act of Parliament requires choral service morning and evening, regardless of who's there. After all, God's there. The verger, who doubled as parish clerk, the vicar's wife, if she were well, and 12 old ladies of both sexes. You know, we're going to renew it. With what? How? A newcomer gets interest in religion and drops in one Sunday morning. That fixes it. Well, here, too, we're seeing a great revival of interest in religion. Departments of religion on campuses, both private universities and state universities, are growing apace. University of California, Santa Barbara, where I live, is now moving up to the MA level with many majors in religion. And it is said all over the country that its growth is such that in 4 or 5 years there may not be enough persons with PhDs in religion to teach all those enrolled. Religious books sell. People come out to hear about it. They don't go to church. Maybe in Florida that's different. But this shows two things. There has been a growing disenchantment with the institutional church. There's no question about it, rightly or wrongly. But with the enormous complication of life and the rapid change of life and the insecurities it brings and the almost astonishment it brings, there is a growing yearning for meaning. And the two are going hand in hand. Some things have happened since the official doctrinal pattern of the churches was established. And sometimes church officials are too busy being corporation presidents to know that these things have happened. Or if they do realize it, they think that the little people don't know, like you. And my brother bishops, some of them will say, "Jim, we know all this, but keep quiet about it. Don't let them know. They want to hear the old records played." You know, they aren't raising any questions. They're happy. Why disturb them? Just say it the old way. Makes them feel good. That's a naive view. It's best answered in a new book by Father Hans King, barred from speaking on Roman Catholic campuses in this country at first, and eventually one of the architects of the Vatican Council, a great, great theologian. In his new book, Freedom Today, from which I read in my brief 10-minute unprepared defense at Wheeling, he says, not to tell the truth because of the so-called pious little ones is to take the risk of offending the intelligent. Furthermore, it's an excuse for theological laziness. Furthermore, it underestimates these little ones in their capacity to receive the truth. And I would add to that, the little ones are not so little anymore. They're getting brighter and brighter. A lot more people are going to high school, that helps. And a lot more are going to college. And some of them are asking more profound questions than the bishops have time to ask themselves, because it is a busy job being a corporation president, as I found out. So I resigned that role so that I could be a bishop, namely a thinker and defender and teacher of the faith, to have some time to do it. I find that the people as a whole and the new theologians are thinking about the same questions. I find the church officials are the ones out of the ball game. They'll catch on when the statistics continue to go down. That does interest prelates and denominational executives. Then they begin to wonder and ask questions. What is wrong? Now, these are the things that have happened since the official statements. Now I can see you better. Thank you. Not meant personally, but you remember that text in the second chapter of Mark's Gospel? They could not see Jesus for the press. The formulations, the official doctrines, were drawn up in the Silver Age of Greek philosophy in the 4th and 5th centuries. We don't think that way anymore. It's not that we don't talk that way, we don't think that way. The words don't mean the same thing because the concepts behind them don't. Three persons in one substance. Substance has no meaning in physics anymore with the breakdown of the matter-energy dichotomy. What is a metaphysical substance? What is a spiritual substance? I just don't know. Three persons. Look at the art before the Renaissance, the iconography on the front of cathedrals or stained glass. These aren't people or persons. These are types, abstract types. But look at the art after that. The Rembrandt, the Dutch masters. You see the mole, all the lines, like that Time cover of me. One reason I go around talking so much these days is so a lot of people can find out I don't really look like that. And I don't have hepatitis either. But now we picture and value the individual person. We value personality. We value peculiarity. Everyone's peculiar. Some people more so than others, I grant. But the speciality of persons is of top value to us. So today, when you say three persons, you cannot help but, this is one of my phrases my brother bishops have called vulgar and crude, but I'm going to say it. I've already been censured, so I can say anything now. You cannot help but get the picture of a committee god. This is one reason we're not getting anywhere in Africa. Islam is gaining 5-1, 10-1 over us. There are a number of reasons for that. One reason is that if you're in the bush and you've had 25 gods and you're going to simplify your religion, you're just suited to go down to one and not stop off at three. And for us to say, well, there are three, but it's only one and it's a mystery, it reminds me of once I preached at a Chinese-speaking congregation in the Diocese of California, and they all looked blank, and I didn't understand it. The reason is that they didn't know English. And so the vicar said, well, what the bishop was talking about is a mystery. Well, it doesn't help any. That they don't understand it is not strange. We don't either. Because what do you mean, three persons in one substance? It isn't even something you can debate about. Two natures in one person. What's a nature in a person? Two natures. What are two of them? Sounds a little skitsy, and I know we don't mean that about Jesus. What could it mean? I don't know. We're not full of abstract non-thinking. We think in verbs, in action, in particulars, in the specific, in the concrete. Another thing. The vice president referred to it. There was Copernicus, and that's been taken into account in every field of knowledge except theology. The main problem isn't the one that my friend Bishop Robinson pointed out, that the God up there problem. It was a problem for me homiletically for a while. You would say, you know, Almighty God, and I'd have to say, down boy, you know, I mean, not up there necessarily anymore up there. Then you say he's in the depths, but then they can't see that gesture behind a pulpit. So then you got to, he isn't down there either particularly. It's just, you know, in and under and beyond. It does change your preaching style a little. But that's not the main problem. The real problem of the pre-Copernican thinking of all the official formularies of the churches and our liturgies and everything else and our articles of religion, confessions of faith, the real problem is the geocentric parochialism. geocentric parochialism, the illusion, the arrogance, to think that this little planet around an unimportant star in a single galaxy of a vast universe is the total center of God's attention. So we say, only begotten Son, once and for all, and all those phrases. Salvation only through one figure, all else damned. One can only be saved, our prayer book says, by baptism, by water and the Spirit, unless our particular ceremonies happen. Only can you enter the kingdom of heaven. The arrogance of this. As I say, in every other field of knowledge, we've broken out of that. We realize the earth is not flat and that it's not heaven above, hell below, and we're the center of all the attention. But not in theology. This has been a grave change. And the old won't do. It will not do. There's another problem. These honest sociologists have been turning their attention to gathering statistics as to what the correlation is between church membership and depth of church commitment, degree of orthodoxy, and socio-ethical attitudes. That's very embarrassing. Because we parsons, particularly college chaplains, used to say, one reason for the church and all this is to preserve the ethics in society. There is a correlation between religion and ethics, all right. Every study I've been studying at the center in Santa Barbara shows there is a correlation. It's a reverse correlation. This is getting embarrassing. And so some who are opting out, like Father Charles Davis in his statement, the leading Roman Catholic theologian, stress very much the moral grounds for leaving the church. This is very common. That's a problem. But the graver problem still, and this one I'm talking about tonight, though I've already introduced it in part, and the Vice President helped me get it introduced, is a conflict between science and religion, which is not the one that we used to deal with, and I think deal with successfully. What used to be thought the conflict between science and religion were in things like this. We're learning from the data method, the empirical method, through geology, paleontology, a different view of the evolving of man than the narratives in a holy book, in Genesis, more particularly in the Pentateuch. So for a while, the church continues to hide from the data and says, we have the answers in the book. But it comes round, again, drag kicking and screaming, to be sure. After having put a few people down for heresy, it came around. There are always a few casualties along the way, and the church is generally the taillight, not the headlight, when it comes to truth anyway. But they came around. There was no conflict anyway, because why should you expect to get your science out of that light blue-covered volume found in every hotel and motel in the land, courtesy of the Gideon Society? If you're in Utah or southern Idaho, there's a second volume provided for you, the Book of Mormon. It has some scientific affirmations also, of equal value. It's just that the theologians were out of their field, and it wasn't a conflict between science and religion. It can happen in reverse. Some years ago, a distinguished scientist in the field of, I suppose you'd call it, sexology, the University of Indiana, put out with a staff two rather fat volumes. You recall one related to the human male, the other the human female. Incidentally, when you'd read the first, you really didn't need terribly to read the second, because in the nature of the case, there was a certain degree of correlation between the statistics. Knowing about these things is useful. Nothing wrong about that. Some reviewers at the time challenged the accuracy of the figures. Some pointed out that some people are reticent to tell the truth about their activities in that realm, And others pointed out the opposite effect, that some people fantasy a bit. Like the lady who went to confession every Saturday night and confessed the same sin of the flesh, and after a few weeks the father said, "I don't know who you are, of course, but I recognize the voice, and I don't think I can give you absolution this time." She said, "Why not, Father?" "So because I don't think you're showing a firm purpose of amendment. You confess the same sin every Saturday night." "Oh," she said, "Father, really? That happened a long time ago. Well, why do you keep coming in here confessing it?" "Well, Father, I just like to talk about it, you know." Well, there's that danger too, but I suppose the shyness and the over-elaboration or pride might balance each other out, and we probably have some pretty sound statistics there as of the period they were compiled. But we call that science. But larded in to page after page is a notion, a theory, a message. Namely, that what people do is what they ought to be doing. Now, this is no longer science.